The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the talk I want to give this morning could be titled The Radiance of Emptiness. And the idea of emptiness, the teaching of emptiness, has been a very important time-honored teachings in Buddhism down through the ages. All schools of Buddhism have some kind of teachings that focuses on emptiness. And in some schools, it's considered to be among the highest teachings of Buddhism, the most profound, depending on how you like that metaphor. And so I want to talk a little bit about how emptiness is taught in our Buddhist tradition. And first I'll say that in the West, the word emptiness often has associations with something bleak. And, I felt really empty. It usually means you didn't feel particularly good. And so there are those kind of negative associations in the way we use it here in the West, but it's not entirely this way. There was a famous Christian theologian named Henry Nouwen who had a very famous teaching or phrase that I don't have it with me, but it goes something like this, that compassionate care involves creating a friendly, empty space in which people can come and talk. So the idea of creating a friendly, empty space, I guess, to allow room for people to be who they are, and they can come and talk and share their suffering or grief. And I think a little bit the spirit of this emptiness teaching is one that allows everything to be as it is. And you get to be yourself once you understand this emptiness thing, even though there's no you there to allow it. But that's partly why it's so easy to be yourself then. The idea of calling this talk The Radiance of Emptiness comes from a little story from the time of the Buddha of one of his primary disciples named Sariputta, I guess, came out of meditation and was particularly radiant that day. And the Buddha said, "Where have you been abiding? Where have you been in your meditation state?" And Sariputta said, I have been abiding in emptiness." And so the idea that somehow this emptiness, whatever emptiness is, abiding in emptiness is in this particular story, it's not a bleak thing. Someone is associated with it, connected to it, resting in it, comes out of meditation in a way that's radiant. And we're talking about people in Buddhism and how to mature people, bring happiness to people, free them from suffering. And that's often the reference point. You know, what is it that's helpful for us? So the teaching of emptiness is meant to be helpful for us, not to leave us in some bleak landscape where nothing counts. To appreciate maybe this teaching of emptiness, you have to, or Buddhism as in general, is you have to a little bit appreciate that the paradigm or the general viewpoint that Buddhism has for looking at the world is probably different than one you have. And so to enter into this kind of exploration of these teachings, kind of a little bit of a willingness to feel your way or try to understand something you don't understand yet. Because if it's only a matter of seeing yourself and what you already believe, then it's harder to find freedom from what you believe, freedom from your ideas that you have. And so a little example would be, a big example maybe, that the starting point, one way of understanding the starting point of all of Buddhism is your own mind, to understand your mind, how your mind works and how it functions. As opposed to sometimes in the West, in Western theistic religions, the starting point is God. In the beginning there was the Word, or in the beginning there was God, and God made the world. The Buddhism begins with there was the mind, and the mind created the world that we experience, that we know, that we project, The mind has a very important role. So if your assumption is that spirituality or life itself is about a relationship to something other than yourself, that's a particular paradigm. And in the West, many people, spirituality has very much to do with the relationship with something other than oneself, with God, with something ultimate, with something. The starting point in Buddhism is not with focusing on something other that you have a relationship to, but rather that you want to discover and look deeply into your own mind and understand that. And so I've been in Christian Buddhist dialogues with people, and sometimes Christians are sometimes perplexed listening to a Buddhist because there's such a strong expectation for a relationship to something as part of their spirituality. And when they don't hear that and Buddhism is presented, they're like, well, is this religion even? Both are great religions. I'm not saying one is better than the other. And perhaps if you do either one all the way, they come maybe to the same point. And I've met Christian practitioners, mystics, who've deeply practiced some of their Christian practices. And the way they talk, the way they relate, it seems like there's much more meeting of minds than not. But it's this different, this kind of starting point is different. And so if you come to Buddhism, you want to kind of a little bit reflect on, are you already coming with a particular paradigm, a particular understanding that that maybe you can put a question mark behind? Maybe what you understand, what you think, maybe there's another way. And this teaching of emptiness is often, for many people, pulls the rug underneath what they're kind of standing on, their beliefs they're standing on. And some people, when they get a hang of this, begin to get a hang of this emptiness teaching, get kind of wobbly for a while. Like where do I stand? And what do we do here? So the idea of emptiness in our tradition has three aspects to it. There's the empty, there's the emptying, and there's emptiness itself. So there's recognizing what is empty, there's recognizing a process of emptying oneself of unnecessary aspects of the mind, and then there's the state of emptiness that one attains when one has properly emptied the mind of its gunk. That's not a technical Buddhist word, but... So this thing about empty, that things are empty in a particular way. So we have to start looking, well, how do these Buddhists talk about what way are things empty? And so I'd like to suggest five different areas of how we can look at this empty, what's empty. The first would be that it has a lot to do with inherence, the idea that there's something absolutely true. This is how it is in things. It's empty of that absoluteness. So, for example, our experiences are empty of absolute inherent meaning. Our human minds are meaning-making machines. That it really wants to find meaning in things. And maybe you'll forgive me if I use one of my common stories that I like. The danger of using common stories, they'll end up with a documentary about it. I don't know if those of you were at the celebration we had. There was this particular story I tell about my practice, and they dramatized it on a video. So I'm reluctant to tell any stories more than twice. So I'm not going to tell any personal stories today. But the story has to do with Sylvia Borstein, a teacher at Spirit Rock, who called up the San Francisco Zen Center, and she wanted to come and be a guest there. And they said in the office, well, the guest director is not here, and he'll call you back. But he didn't call back. So she called back to Zen Center, and they said, is Robert there? And they said, no, he's not here. And then Sylvia said to them in the office, she said, I think this means I'm not supposed to come to Zen Center. And their response was, no, I think this means that Robert's not here. So this idea of, you know, finding meaning in things, we do a lot. And we kind of need to do it. It's a human capacity. It helps us make sense of the world and make order of it and find what's reasonable and predictable. So it's not a wrong thing necessarily, but sometimes it's inaccurate. And sometimes there are other perspectives, other meanings that are better, perhaps. So, for example, if a friend of yours is comes late to a date, of course that means that your friend disrespects you, right? You know, it's kind of like, oh, one more time. And you might carry with you this, like, because it's happened many times before, and you've had a conversation with your friend, how important it is for them to show up and respect you by, you know, honoring your time, whatever. And here they are doing it again. This means. And then you get a phone call, and the person was actually going to be there early for the meeting, but was in a car accident. Someone rear-ended your friend. They're in the hospital. So the fact that they were late didn't mean they disrespected you. It could have meant that. You know, so it's not. But if you had held on to that view, this is how it is, your opinion, you know, is true, before you get the full data, evidence, then you could cause all kinds of harm in the world. You could call up your friend and, you know, and say unkind things. When your friend comes out of the hospital, listens to the answering machine, and you know, oh, gee, you know, this is not nice. So to be careful with meaning, the idea that we assign meaning. And so one of the ideas of empty, what's empty, emptiness, is that meaning is something that we create, like the existentialists say, something we create, and it has validity and value, but be very careful not to take it being absolute. The things are empty of absolute inherent meaning. And so we can engage in the process of meaning making, but we can do it with responsibility and care rather than do it automatically and then assume this is how it is. The second area where things are empty is they're empty of inherent value. And this is maybe for some people harder to appreciate. But value means good and bad. So, you know, how do we decide things are good and bad? So if I tell you that I have a friend who's, recently took a knife and just kind of poked into someone's side and, cut the side up. That sounds pretty bad until I tell you the person's a surgeon. So to take a knife and poke someone, you know, if you're a mugger, it's kind of bad. But if you're a surgeon, maybe it's good. So the idea of taking a knife and poking someone is not in itself have inherent value, but in the context that you're in. So the idea of emptiness would be careful not to impute absolute value on something that's outside of the context that it's in. And then the context it's in, you have to be very careful to understand what that context is. So for example, in the last 10,000 years, for a long time, there's been all kinds of ideas about the value of certain ways of being involved sexually with partners, sexual partners, even alone, even. And, you know, very strong strictures about what's right and wrong. And it's very painful what society puts on people and these kinds of ideas. But rather than putting value that's fixed and absolute, what's the context for the sexual behavior that people do? And the Buddhist analysis would be, in the context in which it's occurring, is anybody being harmed? Anybody being hurt? And if someone's being hurt, we don't want to hurt someone in Buddhism. And so you want to be careful, and that's where the value is found. Oh, this is hurtful, this is painful. If no one's being hurt, there's no need to judge it good or bad. If someone's benefiting, maybe then we can evaluate it as a good thing. It's a nice thing, whatever form of sexuality it might take. So this idea that that nothing has inherent value of good and bad except in context in the situation we find ourselves in, and that's malleable and fluid, and so we don't get stuck on a fixed idea of how things are, but we enter into situations ready to study them and understand them and be slow to assign value to them or decide whether this is useful or not useful. So that's another area of this looking for how things are empty, the Buddhists would say. Another area, third area, would be things are empty of our projections. Or, you know, too often they're filled with our projections, but inherently we have projections, which means assumptions, beliefs, ideas that we overlay on top of other people, experiences, events. And so, like, you know, if you have a role in life, a particular professional role, you probably have had the experience of some time when you don't think you're in the role, you're home or something at a party and having a good time, and lo and behold, someone says, oh, you know, you're a plumber, aren't you? You know, I have this plumbing problem at home, and, you know, and you don't want to be a plumber. But so you're projecting plumberness on the plumber. You know, I mean, in Buddhism we say that someone's only, not literally, I've never heard this teaching, but the idea being, you're only a plumber when you're plumbering. You're only a nurse when you're nursing. So when you're actively involved in your activity, then we have that role, then we can call us that. And so we project, you know, but we carry with us these ideas of, oh, that person is that profession or role, and then we apply it to the person perhaps in a time when it's not appropriate or is not appropriate in that context. Or we have all kinds of projections about people based on all kinds of, our society is replete with very, very painful experiences where one group of people projects ideas and values and meaning on other groups of people. And, you name it. It goes on all directions. And some of it is to extreme forms of discrimination to the point of people losing their lives because of that and succumbing to violence and lots of fear because we project, oh, that person's dangerous, that person's bad, that person's somehow something. And so we overlay our ideas on top of them. And so to start seeing, to understand that the person we're looking at, it doesn't really contain the projection, the idea, the value that we're putting on them. That's our job. If we understand our mind, if we have a habit of looking at our mind, say, oh, this is an idea, an assumption, belief that's born in my mind, and I'm using it now to look, it's a lens through which I'm seeing. And to take responsibility for that lens, that projection, instead of, you know, dumping it on someone else inappropriately. So the idea of projection would put on it, it's very deep. And a kind of a simpler example would be that something like you come into a room and you might already have an idea of what this room is. So here, you come into this room, this is we call it the meditation hall. And so you relate to it, you have this idea, you carry with you the idea of a meditation hall. Some of us have planted this idea in you. This is a meditation hall. But it's not always a meditation hall. A week or two ago, it was a celebratory hall. And
I don't know if this is bothering you.
Yeah, I don't know. Thank you. Sometimes flowers kind of irritate me. So, so is this room a meditation hall inherently? We could decide to have a dance party here, and then some Saturday night, and then people will come to the front door and say, "Where's the dance? Where's the dancing? Where's the dance hall?" What was the meditation hall becomes a dance hall. Or, this used to be a sanctuary for a church. It wasn't a meditation hall; it was a sanctuary, or it was a prayer hall, maybe, or something. Or we could decide that this is going to be. We have kids programs here. And this place is wild. It's a playground. We have all these zafus, you know, these rounds, and they build castles and forts, and they're jumping and, you know, throwing them around. And I don't think it's a meditation hall. Our meditation hall, don't do that. You know, poor kids, poor Gil. But rather, if we say, oh, you know, now it's a playground for these kids. It's great. I'm so glad that they can feel comfortable here. So we have these ideas of what, you know, projections onto things. And I saw that in a very powerful way when I first went to Tassajara, the Zen monastery deep in the Los Padres National Wilderness. And I was driving in for the first time, and there were these beautiful oaks, coastal oaks that I saw, and these different trees and stuff. And I was kind of taken by all the trees that I was seeing in that area. And I had this very distinct feeling or experience that the tree was a tree, of course, but there was an activity in my mind that was painting tree on top of the tree. That I had a kind of concepts and idea, words of what, you know, a tree. And there was something going on in my mind that was kind of, and the language I used back then was, I was painting my reality. And of course, what I saw was kind of there, but I was kind of painting it. In the same way, if you come into the meditation hall, you're painting this a meditation hall. If it's a dance hall, you paint it as a dance hall. And so many things are, you know, are not inherently something until we assign them a projection, an idea, something we go on. So this idea of emptiness is that things can be empty inherently, absolutely, of our projections. And this is a really important area in life. A lot less suffering in life if you own, understand the way your mind overlays concepts on reality. One of those, the fourth area of what's empty, and one of the ones that Buddhism emphasizes a lot, is that things are empty of self. And we're empty of self, even though we say some people are full of themselves. The idea is that inherently we're empty of self. And this is one of the areas that's much more challenging to understand and appreciate in Buddhism. But if you understand it as we internally will project onto ourselves. So, you know, we can have a role, and we can see ourselves in that role, and we can't put it down. No matter where we go, we're going to have that role, and we want people to see us that way, you know. And, you know, I'm a plumber, and everyone should see me as a plumber all the time because, it's, you know, whatever. Or a Dharma teacher, right? That's my role. You know, but, you know, I hope everyone sees me as a great Dharma teacher everywhere I go. And it'd be great, you know. And it's actually a relief when people don't see me as a Dharma teacher. But you know, that's one of the idea. It can be, you know, I can internalize these things, and I live in that projection myself. Or I can internalize meaning or value. I'm a good person, I'm a bad person, I'm a worthy person, I'm an unworthy person. Sometimes we internalize the values that other people or society put on us, that the kind of person we are is an unacceptable person in some way and or something. And so then some people internalize that and they carry that with them in difficult ways. Sometimes our life experience, sometimes all kinds of things where we impute value on ourselves. Conceit, maybe we put too much value on us. We think we're great. And it's something the mind does, an activity of the mind, a kind of projection, a kind of putting some value on it. And when we see it as being inherent, this is how things really are, then we're going to suffer around that. We're not going to be fluid. We're not going to be able to adjust with circumstances and situations in our life as they change. We're kind of like holding on to something. So so this idea of it gets more subtle, the idea of the projection of self or the idea of self, that even the what's seemingly very subtle or very inherent idea of being the agent or being the observer or being the person who's experiencing things, being the, you know, that's me, is an activity of the mind which turns out to not to be inherent, to has to be there in the mind. But if we take this idea that there's an agent, there's an observer, there's a me here, it creates a kind of hardness or has a kind of lack of fluidity with the changing circumstances of our life. And so life runs into that sense of meanness and it hurts. In Buddhism, they talk about lowering the flag of conceit. If you're holding up a flag, I guess people can see you and aim at you. You know, like a target or something. Life, reality has a target for you, you know. But if you lower that flag, then I guess no one's aiming at you. Or to say it differently, reality does what it does, but if I hold my hand up kind of vertically, flat, and I come with the other hand and you know, run into it, you know, do it hard enough and it hurts my left hand, right? So there's one option is to have this very loose, the left hand. And I come along, and then it just kind of bends backwards, and it doesn't hurt as much. But another option is to not have anything up there at all. And so the right hand, as it goes through the air, just doesn't hit anything. And so even the very subtle idea of me being an agent, me being the doer of something, can, in some circumstances, create a barrier, a wall in which reality or our own ideas of self, our own values, can strike and cause suffering. So in this deeper kind of realm of Buddhism, then the idea is to learn to recognize that there's no inherent agent, there's no inherent observer in our experience. And in that lack of inherency, to be much more relaxed and much more fluid and much more participatory in the kind of self we create and the kind of ideas we hold. Sometimes it's very helpful to have the idea that I'm an agent. Sometimes it's helpful to have the idea that I'm an observer. Sometimes it's helpful to not have those ideas. And so if you're not holding on to them or fixated on any of them, because then it's easier to live in a happy way, in a relaxed way or harmonious way with your world around you. The final form, so there's five kinds of things that what things are empty of. Empty of meaning, inherent meaning, absolute meaning, inherent of absolute value, absolute projection, absolute sense idea of self. And the last is a kind of maybe a summary of all those, which is its absent of any inherent existence, that nothing at all exists inherently by itself in some absolute permanent way, that everything is in flux, everything is conditional, everything arises in dependence on other things. It's a fluid dynamic world, it's a process dynamism to the world that we live in. And if we want to be in harmony with the world as it is, we want to kind of begin appreciating the process by which things are, rather than kind of getting hung up and stuck that things are a certain way, anything at all. So even something like death, we might have ideas of what death is, but we don't know what death is. Death is part of a process, an ongoing process. What happens if we see death as part of an ongoing process rather than a fixed idea of, as fixed idea of meaning, value, self, you know, projected ideas of the future and connected to it? What happens? If we see all the ways we project onto it, all the way we put value and stuff on it, on the ideas of death, it might be easier to kind of take them as being relative, as being provisional, as being maybe not even accurate, maybe not useful, and then maybe to let go of these concepts of, you know, and it'd be easier to face the concept of death. Interestingly enough, the Buddha said, when you see the world as empty, you will be beyond death. Isn't that interesting? So you're beyond the reach of death, you're beyond death when you really understand this emptiness thing. But the way to understand this, the way this works, is then there's a process of emptying. And so we begin to empty the mind of what I call gunk. The stuff that gunks it up, that kind of, you know, glues it all up, gets it all stuck. You know, we have all this old chewing gum in there that is, you know, drying and sticky. And so the mechanisms don't quite work so well with all this old chewing gum stuck in there. You know, all the attachments and clingings and resistance and all that. And so what are those? What is some of the gunk that we have? A lot of it has to do with desire, aversion, and delusion. This is kind of the common things that the Buddhist tradition emphasizes. So to have a really strong kind of fixated desire, like addictive desire, like we really have to have this, I want it. It's fine to have desire, but it's the kind of the drivenness of desire. When there's kind of a drivenness behind it, then there's no freedom, because something's driving us in the desire. And that desire, all kinds of desires like that, help us create the world we live in, because a lot of desires are behind our projections, our values, our desire, our sense of meaning. We want something, and because we want something, we're predisposed to judge and evaluate things according to what we want. We want safety, we want status, we want success, we want relationships, we want pleasure, we want all kinds of things. And with that, when we're stuck on those, then we can't really see. And we're often then involved in the world of concepts and ideas, and if we're really driven by those ideas, we can't see how those ideas are conditional, how they're empty of inherent existence. So one of the and same thing for aversion or hate. It's very hard to see things clearly when we're driven by hate or hostility, resentment, because it tends to create a kind of sense of solidity or absoluteness behind the ideas we have, the projections we have, the meaning we have. So what we start doing in Buddhist practice is starting to learn to, the language is emptying ourselves of those, which means to begin to calm down, relax the mind, to quiet down the agitated activity of the mind. And the specific example, the language the Buddha uses for this idea of emptying is the language of emptying ourselves of disturbances in the mind, the way the mind is agitated or disturbed. And so there's a process then he describes of letting go of, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, the hindrances, letting go of our external concepts of the world, letting go of the internal concepts of ourselves, letting go of more and more of the mental activity that often kind of churns away and spinning around. And the mind gets quieter and quieter. As the mind gets quieter and quieter, calmer, more settled, more peaceful, it's not going to be picking up all these thoughts and ideas that come along. It's not going to be spinning around and churning away so much. And so the advantage of that is that we start seeing more clearly. And one of the things we can start seeing when we have a calm mind is the projections, is the ideas, is the imputing of absoluteness on our experience, our beliefs we have, the way we create a sense of self, the way we operate from a sense of self. And we see that the innocent, seemingly innocent idea of there being a self, me here, me, myself, and mine, is not inherent, but rather it's a product of the mind. So, for example, if all of us left today, and we left with different shoes than we came with, our shoes wouldn't care. The idea of my shoes belongs to a product of your mind. It's an idea you have. It's a useful idea. We wouldn't want you to go home with shoes which are too small and uncomfortable or something. But it's a useful idea. It keeps the world in an ordered place. But it's just an idea. So to give you a different example, some of you are sitting on chairs here or using an IMC cushion, or you have your spot on the hall, and you decide to get up to go to the bathroom, and you come back, and someone's sitting in your place. In your place. That was my place. And this becomes very consequential. It was my place. And then self-righteous, and how could the person, and this ties into all the ways I've been disrespected in the past, and so we assign meaning and value and all these things on it. Another possibility is to see, look at that. My mind came here and created the idea of my chair. I didn't even know I was creating the idea of my chair. It's so deep in my mind. And when I leave here today, I'm going to not have any idea where I was sitting anymore. It's not going to be mine anymore. But for this hour and a half, it was my chair. Oh, I'm doing that. Do I have to do it? Is it necessary to do it? Is it necessary to pick up all the ideas of self and what this means and all this stuff to get in the world? There's another chair just like, five chairs over. Why don't I make that my chair? So the idea of kind of looking and seeing, that things don't have any inherent existence except for what the product of mental activity. So the emptying is to empty their sense of activity, get calmer and calmer, so we have a vantage point in which to understand. Also, it's an opportunity to go deeper and deeper and begin letting go of the deepest, deepest beliefs, values of what we have in our mind. And in doing that, to find an incomparable peace, an incomparable sense of well-being, of peace, of expansiveness, of openness, of freedom, that comes almost as if it's an inherent part of the mind. The one thing that's inherent in the mind, as some Buddhists will say, is that it's vastly spacious, so much so that sometimes it's likened to the sky. And in some schools of Buddhism, the word, like in Chinese and Japanese, the character that's used for to write, they have character, write pictures, right? Characters. They use for emptiness is the same as the word for sky. The sky is kind of empty, but the sky is beautiful. And so it can be beautiful. So a clear sky, a sky that's empty of smog, sometimes you look at it and, wow, that's beautiful. And it's kind of sometimes very inspiring to have a great, vast vista of the world, of the sky. So when the mind is like that, empty in that way, and you have this tremendous vista of the great, spacious, sky-like quality of the mind, and resting in that, so much so that there is no observer of it. There's no one experiencing that spacious mind. There's no center, there's no self and other in that experience. Then in Buddhism, in this early tradition of Buddhism that we're part of, that's called abiding in emptiness. So this whole teaching of emptiness has to do with recognizing what is, what things are empty of, and then involves emptying the mind of its extra activity. And it's a lot easier to empty the mind of its extra activity if we understand that how empty so much of the world is. Because then we're not holding on to it for dear life. We're stuck on it or clinging to it. And so we can start relaxing. And then the mind relaxes and empties itself out. And then if that's done thoroughly, the more thoroughly it's done, then this sky-like quality of freedom, the peaceful quality of an open, free mind, becomes who you are. It's not something you attain, but it becomes who you are even though you're not there. And that's a relief. And then when you come back, then you can be much more creative and responsible for how you pick up your ideas, including the ideas of self. And you can use them wisely and usefully and find your way in the world with them. They're not wrong to have these things. It's just that you can hopefully be free in how we use them, unburdened by all these ideas, unburdened by self. So I don't know how much this made sense, but I just wanted to offer you one of the more difficult and profound teachings of Buddhism, and maybe it resonated enough that you put a big question mark around how you usually think about life. How is it I think about life? Is it really going to be that way? So we have a couple of minutes before the end. Do you have any comments or questions you'd like to raise? Yes.
So I actually had a very interesting experience with the concept of self this week. Yeah. I Googled myself, which is actually not something I usually do. I don't think I've done it for years. And, you know, I saw myself first, like, looking at the text entries and thinking, oh, good, there's nothing here that I, you know, don't like in terms of who I think I am. And there were actually some nice things. And so then I thought, oh, good, people, you know, will think good things about me. So that was the first piece, but the thing that really got me was there was a photo of me from 10 years ago, and it was a photo I took because I was trying to market the practice I was in at the time. And I was trying to market to a certain economic strata of people. And so in the photo, I'm all glammed up. My full-on makeup, my hair is bleach blonde. I looked at it and I thought, oh my God, I don't want people to see this because that's not who I am anymore. And that's not me, and what can I do about this? And maybe I should call my friend to figure out how I can have it taken off. And I went down this whole path. And it was like a half hour later where I was thought to myself, wow, you know, that's not really different than who I was back then, thinking I had to look a certain way in order to attract a certain number of people, etc. And who I think of myself as now is like, you know, that person who's not superficial and is down to earth. And I realized that I was just really going down the same path. So it was really very interesting to kind of look at it, you know, kind of using Google as the mechanism to sort of see yourself in a different way.
Yeah. So, thank you. That was great. So I'll tell a little story that's been told many different ways. So you probably heard it, but and then we'll end. That there were two religious leaders, teachers, very spiritual people. And one of them was meditating next to the other one and said, I have no self. I have no self. There's no self. And then the other one, after a while, said, yes, I have no self. I have no self. And then the janitor was going around cleaning the, you know, the place. And the janitor, after a while, said, yes, I have no self. And then the first teacher said to the other one, look who thinks they have no self. It's also painful. It's laughing. It's also painful because of it's very insidious the way that we take these concepts of self and who we are, and then apply them or judge, you know, other people with it, and create the self-other dichotomy. And so we want to be very careful with that. And that this emptiness teaching and this emphasis on the mind and looking at the mind is one way to help us be much more responsible of how we live our lives, our collective lives. So maybe if this can be quick, yeah.
I can speak loud.
No, it's
without a mic. Oh, okay. Oh, got it. Yeah. You mentioned the me observer. Sometimes that's brought up, and so I didn't quite get, so you're saying that's also a part of a me self, to say that there's no me, but there's me the observer, and that's
me. I don't understand. Me as a server.
Observer.
Yes, the observer also is a condition. A phenomena that has no inherence to it. And so, for example, one way to understand this is that there's observing, but no observer.
Say that again.
There's observing, but no observer.
That's what Buddhism says. Is that what you're saying? Yes? Correct?
Yeah.
Versus the mandala of being.
versus the
Mandela,
what?
The mandala of being, they go into that of the observer, that like the observer is kind of me, but it's not really me. Anyway, it's kind of the whole emptiness, but there's the observer part.
It has a very practical, this idea, it's a very practical thing that you can actually experience. And some people can do it if they, it's an example of, you know, my pain. People sit and meditate sometimes on retreats. They have some pain in their knee or something, and if they're very attentive, if we relate to the pain as my pain, it sometimes hurts more than if we relate to the pain as the pain. If we relate to it, I'm watching the pain. I'm the watcher of the pain. I'm the one who's experiencing the pain. It also can hurt more or be more difficult than if we just allow ourselves to let there be watching of the pain, knowing of the pain, without this little extra thing called me that's watching. Because once you have the observer, the self that's watching, it becomes a magnet for all kinds of conscious and unconscious ideas, assumptions of what it means to have a self. It becomes a kind of a hardening up or a constellation of something that's not really needed. And so to have observing without an observer is a way of finding freedom. Does that make a little sense? Mm-hmm. Okay, great, thank you. Well, I hope this was useful in some way. And now you can take your empty self to have to appreciate the emptiness of the snacks. And maybe the wonderful emptiness of our shared community if you stay and hang out and talk. Thank you.